Okay, so welcome to today's sutta class. So do the Namo Tassa first of all, as usually. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So today's sutta class was a request from somebody, and I don't usually give the translations of sutta classes from the Sutta Nipata, and one of the reasons for that is that these are teachings which are given in verse. And when I did learn my Pali, I heard, and it makes a lot of sense, that the verses, they are supposed to be like motivational, inspirational, rather than sort of descriptive of the Dhamma in the sense of giving precise formulations of the Dhamma. And just trying to get an example of what I mean, just this morning, one of my favorite poems when I was a young man, it was from, which is, you know, in the sense of being a Muni, being a sage, being a hermit, was from the British poet William Butler Yeats, "The Lake Isle of Innisfree." I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon's a purple glow, and evening's full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day. I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavements grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core. That was the lake heart of Innisfree. And Innisfree, Innis means like a little peninsula or lake, and obviously it is meaning in is free. In other words, just a play on words. The reason I said that and I mentioned that, because this is poetry. It's inspirational. It doesn't actually mean that peace drips like water from a leaking tap. It was just the analogies which we have in poetry. And much of the Sutta Nipata, from which this today's Dhamma talk is being taken, is again just supposed to be inspirational, supposed to evoke a meaning, especially the meaning of solitude and being a hermit, being free from many of the busynesses of life. So we take it in that spirit. And of course, because it's poetry, it is very difficult to translate and yet keep the inspirational meaning of it. So, and even many of the words which are used in Pali, in poetry, are words which sometimes you don't find elsewhere. Sometimes they are shortened or lengthened to make it the meter, so it flows in a rhythm. And sometimes that means one uses words, ancient words, old words, just to make sure that the whole of the verse, they call it scans. So anyway, that's why it makes it very difficult to translate, but this is the translation of Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi and also Dr. Sadatissa. So it is called, the first one, Muni, the sage. And first of all, talking about the dangers of being a sage. From intimacy, peril has arisen. From an abode, there arises dust. without an abode, without intimacy, this truly is the Mooney's vision. And please, whenever you wish to ask a question, please put up your hand. Intimacy just means being very obviously very close to people, but not just intimacy in the sense of being close to people, but intimacy where we get used to and attached to things. You may become intimate in the sense of being used to our Buddhist society of Western Australia, which means that, you know, if it burns down or something, sometimes people have a lot of tears. So intimacy is where another word almost for being attached or dependent upon something. Not just people, but also places where one finds happiness, which are physical. And from an abode there arises dust. Again, the intimacy being a place, not just a physical abode, but an abode where you're used to, a place basically where you hang out. There arises dust. And the dust is not just the physical dust. It is also just the tendency is becomes impure after many years, much usage. So wherever one goes, if it stays there too long, it does get dusty. And the idea of a Mooney without an abode, a place where one lets one's mind and other parts of your five components of existence, when that you don't have an abode, you're just happy anywhere. And without intimacy, without really needing to be close to any place or any being, that is the Mooney's vision. Mooney being like a sage, being like a hermit, being a solitary, wise person. Any questions about that so far? Maybe I'll just go a bit further and then if questions comes up. Fear arises because of intimacy. It's obviously the fear of things being lost or being separated from what you're very close to. Sensual desire is born of the household life. And the household life meaning all of the kids, the partners, and not just that, but just the comforts, the coffee machines, and the TV sets. Homelessness and detachment is therefore appreciated by the sage. In other words, just having no place to actually to call your home, and being detached, free from things. And usually the similar they have is like a bird, which flies from place to place, never only carrying its the weight of its two wings. So you often hear me say about, you never see birds carrying suitcases or backpacks. One who has, having cut off what has arisen, would not foster what is arising or nurture it. They call him a Mooney, living alone, the great Rishi, saw the state of peace. In other words, just whatever arises in our life, we want to just cut it off, dispense with it. And what is arising, you know, in our life, not to nurture it, not to foster it, because otherwise it will grab you. There is the simile which most of the monks know of the Alawa creeper. And the Alawa creeper was a little vine which twisted itself around a big, massive tree in the forest. And the Alawa vine was just so green and soft, and the tree thought, oh, this is fine, it's not going to be a problem to me. I enjoy its contact. It's what arises. And the tree just nurtures it, until the vine gets so strong, so thick and so woody, it strangles the tree and kills it. And then we have one who has cut off defilements that have arisen, who would not plant them again. and who would not enter into what is being grown. He is said to be the solitary wandering sage, that great stage that is seen the state of peace, Nibbana. So hopefully you're seeing this is a person, an ideal of someone who is tending, leaning towards so few possessions, so few places they can call an abode, a wandering sage not clinging to anything. Comments? You okay? Okay, I'll carry on. Having comprehended the grounds, having crushed the seed, he would not nurture it with moisture. Truly that Muni, a seer of the final end of birth, having abandoned thought, cannot be designated. And this grounds, crush the seeds, not nurture with moisture. Remember that this was a time where the agrarian society and the military were probably the most fertile field for metaphors. And this particular metaphor is actually used in another sutta to describe just how, especially rebirth, happens. The ground, the fields, is the kheta, is called the karma. You know, your good and bad karma, which you have created over many lifetimes, having comprehended just how karma is. And the seed is the stream of consciousness, and the moisture is the craving, the wanting. And so the simile is that when stream of consciousness, it takes root, and then because of one's karma, and it is nurtured by the moisture, and then grows and gives rise to another birth. And you can see the idea of a seed coming from somewhere, and it goes into fertile karma, fertile field, and then with the craving, it grows and grows and grows. If the craving is not there, or the karmic causes are not there, it will not grow. Having considered the ground, karma, having discarded the seed, the stream of consciousness, and not supplying moisture for the growth of that seed, the craving, the wanting, having abandoned sophistry, that sage who has been seen the end of birth cannot be categorically described. Oh, that's you got the two. I'm just getting it now, because I have. Looking, this is the idea of thought. The word they use, actually, this is repeating. It's two different translations. I do apologize. I was using Bhikkhu Bodhi's one here. The abandoned thought, abandoned sophistry. The word actually it's not used very much at all in the rest of the suttas. It's called taka. It's not witaka, but taka. And it's just literally like hitting things. The mind just going onto something. And it is. You can use it as thought. You can use it as designating things, describing things, sophistry. All of that type of mental work of thinking, designating, describing, delineating, all of that has been abandoned. And so the end of birth, nothing can be categorically described, gone beyond descriptions. Having known all residences, all places where a person can be reborn, not desiring any of them, he who is truly a Muni, devoid of greed, greedlessness, does not endeavor, for they have gone beyond all of that. Otherwise translated, the one who has known all kinds of births, but does not desire to enter into any of them, such a sage is freed from greed and desire. He toils not for he has reached the other shore, Nibbana, that other shore of crossing the stream, crossing over from this part to the other part. Again, is another simile for like this world, and to go across to Nibbana. A simile again. Questions? Is this going too deep, or are you getting a feel for this is nothing which is trying to get an emotion, trying to get a meaning, trying to get an inspiration rather than being specific. This is what that means, that's what that means. It is poetry. One who has overcome all knowing, very wise, untainted among all things, who has cast off all, liberated in the destruction of craving, such a one the wise knows, a Muni. And all the other translation, one who has overcome all, who knows all, who is intelligent, I prefer wise there, who does not cling to any object. That's a video, a wonderful little saying. Not cling to it, it comes, you let it go. Who has abandoned everything, who has freed themselves by destroying desire, is called a sage by the wise. One with the power of wisdom, equipped with good behavior and observances, concentrated, delighting in jhana, mindful, free from ties, not barren, without influxes, they too, the one the wise knows, a Muni. Alternative translation, one who possesses the strength of wisdom, born of the moral precepts. I like that one, that the moral precepts, in the sense of being born, creates sort of the Muni, who is tranquil in mind instead of concentrated. You know just what I always say about concentrating, being tranquil, being still, and delights in meditation, who is mindful, free from attachment, free from foulness of mind and the intoxicants. In other words, the idea of being barren or a fallow piece of land is a land which is not a land which is not producing anything worthwhile. And this is a life which has produced the end of suffering, freedom, and no more defilements. It's not regarded as like a waste of time to practice things like precepts, sense restraint, tranquility, and jhanas. This is not a barrenness, it's not a waste of time, it's something which gives the highest fruits. Living alone, a Muni, heedful, not swayed by blame and praise, like a lion not alarmed among sounds, like the wind not caught in a net, like a lotus not tainted by water, a leader of others not by others led, he too, or they too, the one, the wise ones know as a Muni. If you get shaken by blame and praise, a lion not alarmed among sounds, in other words, beyond fear, like the idea of a wind not caught in a net, nothing can catch you, or like a lotus not tainted by water, a leader of others, actually just a leader of no one, not led, not by others led, they too the wise know as a Muni. The sage, and this is the alternative translation, the sage who wanders alone, who is diligent and undisturbed by praise or blame, not frightened by noises, like a lion, not caught in a net, like the wind, not soiled by water, like the lotus, leading others but not led by others. One who remains steadfast like a pillar at a ford. I just did read the commentary there, and they said that's where a place where people, once they bathe in the river, would actually rub their body to scratch it, to take off any extra cake, mud or dirt, or to, defoliate the skin. In other words, it was, instead of using bath powder, they would use that to actually to clean their bodies. That was one simile, but it's more than likely that a bathing place means it's a place which is safe in a river. And so be very steadfast. In other words, that a pillar which is not moved. Like a pillar to afford, when others speak provocative words about some matter, they just remain unmoved. They're devoid of lust, with well-concentrated faculties. They too is the one wise. The wise ones know, as a Muni. Alternative, one who is firm as a post in a bathing place, controlled over what others say, who is passionless, whose senses are well composed, is one the wise knowers of Muni. One who is inwardly firm, straight as a shuttle. I don't know if anyone's ever done any weaving before, but even in a village I remember just seeing weavers make cloth which they would obviously wear, and the shuttle being able to move backwards and forwards straight, otherwise the cloth would not be able to see. It wasn't woven well. So inwardly firm, straight as a shuttle, disgusted with actions that are evil, who investigates the uneven and the even, they too, the wise know as a Muni. One who is firm-minded, straight as a shuttle, who despises evil actions, investigating what is good and bad, the wise know as a Muni. How's it going? Carry on? Okay. Whether from the top, the middle, or the remainder, whatever food and alms collector may receive, they do not think to praise or disparage it. They too, the wise, know as a Muni. So, whenever we used to go on alms round, you get all sorts of food in your bowl. And some was delicious food, some was disgusting food. And there was one place in the northeast of Thailand where their delicacy was known as rotten rat. They would catch rats and hang them up by the tail for a few days. And then after the few days, they would actually, it's like game, like birds, which they would wait till they go smelly, and they were called like game. And anyway, and then they would offer the best of those, which was mostly the smelliest ones, you know, to a monk, especially if it was a Western monk. Fortunately, I never got one of those, but one monk did. And that was the end of his hunger for that day, when that got put in your bowl. Rotten rat. Any Thai people here? No, now. Anyway, that was nice. And the other one which they got sometimes was a bat's head. And that was actually cooked, it was boiled or something. But a bat's head is extremely ugly to look at. And when you look in your bowl to see what you've got today, that does not create much appetite. And these are true, I don't make these things up, this is what some monks get. Because it's a subsistence place, it's the only thing which people have. Anyway, does not praise or blame the giver when they've received alms, either from the top or the middle, or the remainder, who neither flatters nor treats with disrespect. They, the one, know as a Muni. The Muni who lives abstinent from sexual union, who even in his youth is not bound anywhere, abstinence from vanity and heedlessness, fully released, they too, the one knows the Muni. And the alternative translation, the sage who wanders alone, who has abstained from sexual intimacy, who even in their youth is not attached to anything, who has attached himself from pride and indolence, is one the wise knowers of Muni. having known the world, a seer of the supreme goal, an impartial one who has crossed the flood and the ocean, whose knots are cut unattached without influxes, they too the wise know as a Muni. One who has known the world, alternative translation, who has perceived the highest truth, who has crossed the flood and sea of existence, who has cut the ties of rebirth, who has no clinging to any sense object, who is free from the intoxicants. We're not talking about alcohol or drugs, but the intoxicants of even like pride and praise and blame. Those also, we can get intoxicated by what people say of us and by the praise and reverence we get. And the two are dissimilar, their dwelling and conduct far apart. The layman supporting a wife and the ascetic owning nothing. The layman is not all laymen, all laywomen, unrestrained in harming other beings, while the Muni, ever restrained, protects living beings. The sage who is, alternative translation, the sage who is accustomed to living in distant places, the egoless and well-conducted one, and the householder who supports a family, they are not equal, for the householder having to support a family is unrestrained and destroys living beings. The sage is self-restrained and protects living beings. A lot of the time, as you know, it's just to be able to support a family. Sometimes your choices are very limited. And for the householder, for the Muni, the sage, the hermit, that they don't need to support families, so obviously they can live in distant places and they do not destroy hardly anything. And the protecting of living beings. I always remember this very sweet story told to me by one of the old forest monks a long time ago, that when he was living in a forest, in the, you know, real jungles, this was a storm, and one night he had heard something knocking on his wooden door. And when he opened the door, it was a monkey, female monkey, holding a stillborn baby. The mother monkey had just given birth, and the little baby was stillborn. And the monkey looked to the hermit monk to ask for help. Never said anything, but just gave the baby to the monk, hoping the baby could heal her little child. And the monk could do nothing. So just, I think, held it for a little while and then gave it back. And just, you know, looking at one another, just, you know, I think he even said the monkey had sort of tears. And then the monkey went away. Even there the monkey thought, maybe this man, this monk, could have some way of helping assuage the monkey's grief. But the monkey just never had any fear. We looked to that hermit monk as someone who might be able to help. Just as the blue-necked peacock flying in the sky never approaches the speed of a goose, the idea being that peacocks are very bright and fashionable and colourful. Goose or geese are just white or grey or something. So the lame man is no match for the bhikkhu, a Muni meditating secluded in the woods. Alternative translation, the blue-necked peacock which flies through the air never approaches the speed of the swan. Similarly, the householder can never resemble the monk who is endowed with the qualities of a sage who meditates aloof in the jungle. So that was a little poem, not ever meant to disparage the lay life, but more to actually to encourage the idea of a person who lives in the forests alone, no attachments, no busyness, And sometimes I look at that and think, what am I doing coming to Nolomar and teaching? Maybe I should just go off into the forest. But it also means there's a society which can actually support that. And of course, when in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, Burma, you can still do that. But nevertheless, hopefully in the future that can be done in Australia, building up the supporting conditions. But at least for times, we can take the idea of a Muni, sage, lives alone with hardly anything. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cave build there, and just disappear into solitude. That is the end of the Muni Sutta. Any comments? Yes. I want one moment, just waiting for the list to come to you.
Ajahn, that this example encouraging people to become monks, that once when you mentioned about the sutta some time back here, I forget the name, but when he asked why you are only giving preference to monks, I think the Buddha said that a farmer, when he has two fields, that he will always plow the better field, not the one that is, which is not good enough to grow the crop.
Yeah.
He said it is the monks, the sage, who is endowed with the good qualities, who can take the Dhamma well, and then it's not the lay people. That is why I give preference to the monks. I think in one of the, either Sanghita Nikaya or somewhere.
And because I am a monk, I have to qualify that. They're real monks.
Real monks.
As you know.
Of course, yes.
Because, and real nuns. It's not anything about male or female. It's not about sort of people who wear brown robes and have bald heads. It's about the real ideal of leaving the world and living in solitude and just not harming anything and not being concerned about praise or blame and realizing just how simply you can live and how little you truly need. Sounds easy, but there's also the Fear and Dread Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, middle length sayings, where the Buddha said that, even going into the forest can sometimes drive you insane if you haven't got a good foundation in stillness, in meditation, which was one of the reasons why he would never let some renunciants go off into the jungles by themselves from the very beginning, only when they had trained by themselves in the, well, actually, and with teachers in monasteries or with good acharyas, and then when they thought they were ready, okay, you can go off by yourself now. Because, as you know, many of you know, going on retreat, by not one of the taught retreats where I give entertainment sessions every evening, Q&A, but just being by yourself, where there's no escape, where you know you can't go talking to people. It's just your mind and your defilements and your inspiration, just those. And then you're by yourself. When I did my 6 months solitude, seeing no one, talking to no one, some even monks, they wondered whether I'd go crazy. And I've been a monk a long time. It does happen because you've got nothing which can tie you to the world. For some who don't know how to be free, sometimes you've got nothing to hold on to. You either really enjoy that or it makes you mad. I think I got pretty free. I don't think I'm that mad. But be careful. Sometimes you don't know the difference. Yes. So now you've got to run all the way over there now.
Ajahn, I was thinking of people at the end of their lives, people who have led busy lives and haven't had time to let go of anything, yeah. Have spent their time accumulating, and it does seem as if those people who are dying a very lingering death have got a golden opportunity, really, that perhaps we don't realize, because that's their time to drop everything off while they're still conscious.
That would be wonderful. But even at the end of one's life, we've made so many knots and attachments. You know what it's like, you know, with your children and your children's children and friends. And sometimes they don't let you die. They don't let you leave. And it's not only that these days, it's also governments and laws. Many of you know Brian Creek. When he passed away, I was really surprised that two policemen came looking for me. I said, "What have I done wrong?" "No, you've done nothing wrong, Ajahn Brahm." But apparently Brian made me the executor of his will. And I didn't realize, oh, well, that's nothing. What? But it was so complicated, tying up somebody's affairs. And it's so many legal things, and just over the years, just so many knots you'd made. And that really sort of was an example of just seeing just how difficult it is, you know, to leave the world and be simple. You know, the world just almost just comes up and ties you. So it's very difficult to disappear and vanish in this world. So the sooner you can do it, the better. But it was also, to be honest with you, it was one of the reasons why as you know, I was quite firm, passionate, I would say, with building Jhana Grove Retreat Center and making sure, you know, little things like en-suites in each room. And I mentioned at the time that this is not just for young, fit people. This is so that people who are getting old, who are coming towards that latter part of their life, who have the opportunity and have the inspiration to go off and meditate. And of course, you know what happens if you're incontinent or you can't walk very well. And why should it be that such people are denied the opportunity to develop the path? You don't all have to just now be able to sit on a floor with full lotus for hours and hours on end. Most people can do that when they're young. But as you get old, sometimes you ache a bit. Sometimes, you know, you have to get up to go to the toilet. Sometimes you need special foods. Sometimes. So it is true what you say, and I really keep that in mind as someone who is a teacher, to make it possible for those at the end of their life. You know, often those people take the meditation retreats more seriously. You don't see so many of those people going up to Kingsbury Drive to get their iPhones out and check their messages. There's supposed to be no iPhone in the monastery, but the bush is so big that they can always walk and find a place to get a good signal. You can't stop them. But anyway, so yeah, why? It's a very good thing to be able to do towards the end of your life. But don't wait too long, because it does take, you lose a lot of energy. You have a lot of freedom if you can take that opportunity to be free. So thank you for that question, sir. Another question? Okay, there is another sutta which is coming on from this. It is sort of similar, But it also includes an old story which many of you may have heard in traditional Buddhism about the birth of the Bodhisattva to be the Buddha and the two hermits, especially Asita and his nephew Nalaka. So here we go. There's no need to make too much explanation here because many of you know this traditional Buddhist story, but then it leads in to another idea similar to the idea of a Muni. And of course Sakyamuni was one of the great epithets of the Buddha. The Rishi Asita, while passing the day, supposed to be up in the Himalaya regions, saw the Tawatingsa Devas, that is the one of the heavenly realms, joyful and ecstatic, having honored Indra, otherwise known as Sakha, clad in clean garments, carrying streamers, they were proclaiming exuberant praise. One day during the afternoon siesta, not siesta, but his afternoon meditation, don't know why they read siesta there, because the sage Asita noticed that the 30 gods had all gathered together, full of joy. Actually, it's supposed to be 33. Full of joy and overflowing with praises to Indra, they were dressed in the purest white and waved their robes and banners with delight, having seen the Devas, the heavenly beings, exultant and elated, having shown them respect. The Rishi, the Sita, said to them, "For what reason is the group of Devas exuberantly jubilant? Why do you take streamers and swirl them around?" Seeing all this excitement, Asita respectfully asked the gods, what it was that they were celebrating? "Why are you all so happy and joyful?" he asked. "What's all this waving and whirling of banners for?" "Even when there was a battle with the Asuras, when the gods were victorious and the Asuras defeated, even then there was no such excitement. What wonder have the gods seen that they rejoice? I had never seen such excitement as this, not even when the gods won their battle against the Asuras. What can they have seen now? It must be something wonderful for there to be all this rejoicing. They whistle and sing and play music. They clap their arms and dance around. I ask you, dwellers on Mount Meru's peak, dear sirs, quickly dispel my bafflement. They are singing and shouting, playing music, dancing around, clapping and waving. Tell me why, you people from the top of Mount Meru. Please answer my question, put my minds at rest. In Lumbini, a village in the Sakyan country, the Bodhisattva, the excellent gem, unequaled, has been born into the human world for the well-being and happiness. Hence we are so delighted and extremely jubilant. In a village called Lumbini, in the Sakyan country, answered the gods, the Bodhisattva has been born, a being set on Buddhahood has been born, a superlative being without comparison, a precious pearl of the health and goodness of the human world. That's we're so glad, so excited, so pleased. He is the best of all beings, the foremost person, the chief bull of men. Now, this is just the epithet. It doesn't mean that they are like some person who's really manly. It just means not even like Red Bull, but just someone who's, you know, this is agrarian society. A really good bull is just like a good horse, a good elephant. These are just precious comparisons. Where's it gone? The best of all creatures, he will turn the wheel of the Dhamma in a grove named for the rishis. That's Isipatana, otherwise known as just outside of Benares, the deer park. Where's it gone? Roaring like a powerful lion, the lord of beasts. That was also one of the epithets, the lion's roar. Of all beings, this one is perfect. This is the pinnacle, the ultimate, the hero of creatures. This is the one who from the forest of the masters will set the wheel of teaching turning, the roar of the lion, king of beasts. Having heard that utterance, this is a Sita, quickly descended and then ascended into the human realm, and then approached the residence of Suddhodana, who was the Buddha's father. Having sat down there, he said to the Sakyans, "Where is the prince? I too wish to see him." When he heard the news, the Sita left the Tusita realm and went straight to the palace of Suddhodana. This is the alternative reading again. There, when he had sat down, he said to the Sakyans, "Where is the prince? I would like to see him." Then the Sakyans showed a Sita their son, who was radiant with splendor of perfect color. The prince shone like gold burnished in the mouth of a furnace by one highly skilled. Alternative translation. So they took the hermit a Sita, the unattached as he was called, and showed him the newborn prince. He was shining, glowing, and beautiful. So he was like seeing molten gold in the hands of a master craftsman as he takes it out of the furnace. And having seen the prince blazing like a crested flame, pure like the moon, lord of stars, moving in the sky like the beaming autumn, not the princesses, the moon. Already delighted, he gained abundant joy. Alternative translation, to see the prince was to see brightness, the brightness of the flames of a fire, the brightness of the star constellations crossing the night sky, the brightness and clarity of the autumn sun shining on a cloudless day. It was sight that filled the hermit with joy, and he experienced great delight. The gods held up a parasol in the sky with multiple ribs and 1,000 circles. Golden-handled chowries moved up and down, but none were seen holding the chowries or parasol. In the sky above, invisible beings were holding up a vast canopy out in circles. From its center stretched over 1,000 spokes. Other gods waved yak-tail fans on golden stems. That's what a chowry is. And these gods too were invisible. The matted hair rishi named Black Glory, having seen him like a golden nugget on a red blanket with the white parasol being held over his head, received him elated and happy. Otherwise known, the long-haired sage, the dark splendors who was called, looked at the baby lying on the orange clothes, shining like a golden coin, with a white sunshade held up over him, with great joy picked him up. Nan, having received a Sakyan ball, examining him, the master of marks and hymns, was pleased in mind and emitted a cry, "He is unsurpassed, the best of bipeds." Now the lion of the Sakyans was in the arm of the man who had waited for him, a man who could recognize all the signs on his body, a man who now, filled with delight, raised his voice to say the words, "There's nothing to compare with this. This is the ultimate, the perfect man." Then, recollecting his own departure from the world, he became dismayed and shed bitter tears. Seeing the Sakyans, asked the weeping rishi, "Will some misfortune befall the prince?" By the translation, just the hermit remembered that he was going to die quite soon, and he felt so sad at this, he began to cry. The Sakyans asked him why he was crying. "Is the prince in some danger?" they asked. And it's okay, I think the second translation is much more beautiful. So shall we just do the second? You can read the first yourself. To settle their worries, the sage explained to them why he felt sad. "No," he said, "there'll be no danger or threat to the prince's life as far as I can see. In fact, for him there won't be any obstacles at all. There couldn't be for him. He's not an ordinary being. This prince will come to the fulfillment of perfect enlightenment. This prince of supreme pure vision will start turning the wheel of truth out of compassion for the well-being of many. The religious life will be fully expounded. But for me," said Asita, "there is a grain of sadness and pain in this, for I will not live much longer now. During his life, I shall die. So I won't be able to see this man of such unparalleled strength teaching how things are. And that's the only reason I feel sad." The Sakyas were thrilled to hear what he said and left them, went out from the inner rooms of the palace and set out to follow the practice of a pure and virtuous life. But as he was leaving, he began to think, this is Asita, began to think of his nephew, Nalaka, and full of compassion, he stopped to tell him about the man of unequal strength and teachings. One day, he said to his nephew, "You will hear someone talking about a Buddha. You will hear of a man who has reached full enlightenment by following the correct path. When you hear this, go and find out all the details of this teaching. Go and live with the Master, this Lord, and follow the practice of a pure life. And Nalaka, helped by the merit he had accumulated by many years of good and wholesome actions, remained alert and restrained, always moderating the play of his senses, looking forward to the appearance of a conquering hero. In time the news did come, the Buddha started to turn the teaching wheel. On Asita's advice, Nalaka went off to find this noble sage, and having done so, asked the man of wisdom about the highest wisdom. And that was the prologue. That was just a story, which many of you may have heard before, just of the Buddha's life story, and being examined by a rishi, and a rishi crying because he realized this was going to be a Buddha and he wouldn't be there to hear the teachings. And anyway, what Asita told me many years before he turned out to be true, said Nalaka, I can see that now. You, Gotama, have reached the perfection of all things. May I now put a question to you, Master? So this is the part about the Muni. I have lived for some time now, said Nalaka, as a wanderer, and now I would like to live as a monk, so please answer this question for me. What is the highest wisdom state? And the sublime master replied, I will explain the wisdom state to you, a state which is hard to get and hard to put into effect. Come, be alert and full of effort. Develop the mind of equilibrium. You will always be getting praise and blame, but do not let either affect the poise of your mind. Follow the calmness, the absence of pride. Forms, both high and low, come across like tongues of flame from a log. Women might tempt the sage, just as men might tempt the female, but you should not develop the sense of desire. Being free from sensuous union, without aversion or attachment towards any being, however weak or strong they may be, comparing oneself to others in such terms, just as I am, so are they. Just as they are, so am I. He would neither kill nor cause others to kill. The impulse I want, the impulse I'll have, lose them. That is where most people get stuck. Without those, you can use your eyes to guide you through this suffering state. Eating little and moderate in food, with few wants and free from greed, you are unafflicted by wants, you are desireless and calmed. This is the pattern that the person of wisdom follows. They go around collecting gifts for the meals, and then they go off to the edge of the wood and sit down under a tree. You apply yourself to meditation practice, steadfast one, intent of jhana. With this skill in this practice, you can find it pleasurable. You can make yourself joyful living under a tree on the edge of a wood, meditating. You spend the night like this, and in the morning set off for the village. You do not get distracted. You do not get excited by the gifts and invitation that people offer you there. Once you have reached the village, you do not rush from door to door. And when you are begging for food, you do not talk about it or pass any hints. You simply say, this is what I've been given, that's good. I haven't been given anything, that's fine. With this attitude towards begging, you can return undisturbed to the tree. So you wander around with begging bowl in hand. Although you are not dumb, you may seem to be dumb. You accept even the smallest gift or the slightest giver without scorn or without pride. Again, I do remember when Ajahn Jokaro went off to Thailand for the first time when I was his attendant for many months. And then one of the girls, she must have been out 10 or 11, came up to me because I had to give a talk. And she said, that's amazing, Ajahn Brahm. I thought you were mentally retarded because you never said anything. She actually said that to me, because I was respectful to my senior at the time, which was Ajahn Jacko, and I would never interrupt him. I'd just sit there quietly, and he'd do all the talking, and people thought that was being dumb. It's not being dumb, it's being restrained. So anyway, the methods, both quick and slow, by which Nibbana may be discerned, have indeed been expounded by the ascetic Gotama. It is never discerned twice. This perceiving of the beyond is realized gradual by the four stages. Never discerned twice was explained quite obviously that once you're enlightened, you don't recede and have to do it all over again. Nibbana is the end, can never be destroyed. When a person is desireless, when a monk or nun has extinguished the river of becomings, and that's the river always flowing over here, flowing over there. When you're giving up all the activities of duty and obligation, the ought to and ought not to, the fever is past. Yes, said the Sublime One, I'll explain the wisdom state to you. Be raised a sharp, keep your tongue relaxed so the tip is resting on the roof of your mouth and your stomach is quiet and your appetite restrained. Let go of the chained minds, the states involving attachment. Do not spend too much time thinking about irrelevancies. No defilements, no ties, no dependency, only dedication to the practice of a pure life. In the disciple, in the discipline of living alone, in the service of hermits, it is the silence of solitude that is wisdom. Wisdom born of silence. When solitude becomes a source of pleasure, sometimes people think solitude is loneliness. Sometimes you think solitude is bad for your health, there's something wrong with you. But when the Dharma starts to really take hold, solitude is a source of pleasure. Then it shines in all the 10 directions. This is the sound of meditation of wisdom. Of those who have let sense pleasures go, when you, a follower, hear this sound, then you grow in confidence, modesty, and strength of practice. Listen to the sound of water. Listen to the water running through the chasms and rocks. It is the minor streams that make a loud noise. The great waters flow silently. I remember that saying for a long time since I was a young Buddhist. It is the small streams make all the noise. The great rivers flow silently. What is empty makes a noise. Oh, sorry. The hollow resounds and the full is still. Foolishness is like a half-filled pot. The wise man is like a lake full of water. A drum, you can beat it and it really resounds. But when you have a solid piece of wood and you knock it, it hardly makes a sound. The hollow ones make the most noise. The hermit can talk of many things with good sense and precision. They can describe the way things are from a position of knowledge. There is much that they can talk about from that position. But when a person of knowledge retains their sense, their self-control, when a man of knowledge, person of knowledge speaks only little, then you have found a man of wisdom, a person for whom that silence is appropriate and deserved. Such a person has found the silence of wisdom. Okay, those were poems. Those were trying to evoke a feeling, not trying to distinguish one person from another person. I'm sorry, usually when I do retranslations, take out gender specifics, take out whatever, to make this relevant for everyone. But hopefully you can get the feeling. What it means to leave the world, to live freely, and just without pride, without wanting, without choice, living freely. That was the ideal of the Muni, the sage. Any question? Yeah. Questions or comments?
Hello. Thank you for that. I really enjoyed all poems. Thank you very much. On the topic of meditation, when you can see and feel yourself benefiting from it and, say, family members, like parents, are on quite a different journey and aren't particularly religious, in your experience, have you found it best to just lead by example, or for people to lead by example, or to gently suggest that they may enjoy meditation, particularly for things like anger and anxiety, if your parents have that, or chronic pain and anxiety?
Yeah, always lead by example, rather than try and be an evangelist to your mother or your father. I remember a stupid monk I was. I was so inspired by living with a great teacher like Ajahn Chah. I'd only managed to get an aerogram, maybe once every month or 2 months. And I'd try and write really small to get as much into that as possible. And trying to basically teach my mother about meditation and Dhamma and simplicity. And when she would reply, she'd mention nothing about what I'd written about. And so it took about 6 months, and I wrote to my mother and said, "How much of this do you understand?" And she wrote back, "Nothing." She put me in my place. And of course, sometimes you get so inspired and just so excited about, you know, what meditation or this path has meant for you. And it's natural, you just want to share it with everybody. You're a pain in the neck for them. So instead, the best thing is to do it by example. You're such a peaceful daughter. And eventually they, "Wow, what have you been doing?" One of the monks, I shouldn't say who he is, but when he first went to visit his family, he showed me the letter which he got back from his family. "Yes, you can come to visit, but you must be wearing a suit, no robes, otherwise we would not pick you up from the airport." And he was very concerned, and so he showed me the letter and I dictated, "It's either these robes or naked, take your choice." So they took him in his robes, looked after him, but just was a little bit dubious about what he was doing. And the next time he visited because his father passed away. And he stayed for 2 or 3 months, and then his brother sent me this letter, which I should have kept. But you know, we try and give things away as a monks. But this said, "We never understood why our brother, you know, joined a monastery. But during the crisis, the turmoil, the emotional confusion and grief of my father's death, we realized all that he'd learnt and all that had changed him. We valued him so much. Without him, we don't know what we would have done. So please understand that he has our family's full and total support for being a monk. Thank you." And it was such a lovely letter. A family who just did not understand why a very intelligent, fit young man decided to become a monk, especially in a country a long way away, and then saw the benefits when it was a real crisis. So just hang in there, and eventually they will come and ask you. Sometimes there's some... Oh, I've got someone on the internet. Here we go. Okay, from Malaysia, could you please explain the difference between the words used for layperson, household, and disciple in the sutta? The first one read, for example, Gihi, Gahaptaka, Upasaka, Sarvaka, and others. Okay, those are Pali words, but, you know, what does it mean to be like a householder? You know, as a person who, you know, you do get caught up in the tangle of even family life. And once you have a family, you know, you do need a place, you do need work, you do need, even if you are very simple yourself, your children may feel, Daddy, the other kids have got this, why can't I have one? And, you know, sometimes that, you know, it's tough as a parent trying to keep your kids living a simple life. You know, just personal anecdotes. I keep on saying this, but it's true, my family were poor. And I remember just going to school, because of scholarships, I went to a really good school. And, you know, one day it just, you know, I lost it in front of my mother. I said, just, all my friends have got these really nice clothes, I'm just wearing patch ones. And I made my poor mother cry. My father said, well, you need to get that off your chest, son, wonderful. But I apologized afterwards, my parents couldn't afford anything. And because, you know, you were in a school where peer pressure, you know, some very rich kids in that school, and, you know, I was by far the poorest. But nevertheless, you know, just, you know, I should never take that out of my mum. But you can see the pressure which maybe you have sometimes, that, you know, you can't really afford what the other kids have, and so your child feels a bit left out, maybe even bullied. I was never bullied, but still I felt just a bit inferior. But the pressures are on you as a parent. That's why a householder is a difficult, complicated life. Of course, being a monk, especially being me, just the amount of work which I have to do, and how complicated my life becomes, and just even poor old Venerable Metaji, we just finished a 2-hour committee meeting about the constitution, about legalities, and about just how we can make sure the Buddhist society can continue on for such a long time in the future. And why do monks have to get involved in this? You know, it's because we can and because we care. But you can see just how even we get entangled in stuff. So it's difficult. But to be able to, at least at the end of your life, if you can, just see if you can disentangle from all the knots which we make in the world. First of all, just, you know, go on a retreat and feel what it's like. Just to have, this is no past which is dragging you back with so-called unfinished business. What's done is finished. No fear for the future. And hopefully that you'll have those experiences. Like as in a monk you had, I just, with nostalgia, just the time when you were just wandering monk, everything you owned, which was hardly anything, you carried on your back, walking through the jungles, through the fields of Thailand in 1978 or 9 or something. You always had people give you some food to eat. Not the best, but it was good enough. And you just, any place you ended up, you could just sleep in the fields, sleep, you know, in the forest, sleep in the charnel grounds was the best, because the villagers were too afraid to go there, so you're really peaceful at night time. All those places you felt free as a bird. The ideal of being free. So that's poetry, it's emotions, it's feelings. Being a monk, being a nun, being a layperson. You see many monks, many nuns, they're more entangled than householders. Many householders just let go of stuff and live very freely, very peacefully. It's up to you how you make use of what you have, or rather, how courageous you are in letting go. Anyway, USA. I've been off by myself for years. How do you avoid becoming a nihilist? You don't become a nihilist or an everythingist. Just as it said there, just all those discriminations and distinguishing, all that thinking and putting things into categories. That is the biggest problem there. That's what we have to do in the world. But if you're really off by yourself and you're a hermit, don't judge. Don't sort of put things into boxes. You notice this when people say even diseases like cancer or OCDC. That's ACDC, isn't it? Whatever it is. We always tend to even like schizophrenia or just stuff. What is that? Just when you put a label on something, people live up to those labels. So becoming a nihilist, what is that? Just trying to put things into boxes where those boxes never really fit. So, don't become a nihilist. Don't become anything. Just be free. From Germany, when will you do your next 6 months solo retreat? I think when I'm dead. Dead to the world. Okay, I don't know how that went, but that's not the usual sutta class, because sutta nipata, just, it's not specific, this is it, this is that. The whole idea is just working with emotions rather than the intellect. So, I don't know how well that went, but anyway, that's what you got. So now we can say the usual, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, because whenever I do those sadhus, it's joyful. Why should you do that? Is that sort of being exuberant? Maybe you can talk about it. Monks aren't supposed to do this, put monks into boxes. But you know, sometimes it's nice just to feel it rather than think it. Okay. Now I'll pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then whatever you need to do, feel free.
Arahaṁ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṁ Bhagavantaṁ Abhivādeti Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghaṁ Namami.
You don't need to stick around here, please. You get yourselves all ready. So get in the car so that we can make a quick getaway. Yeah.